After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern and Duncan Trussell.
Maharaji and Ananda Mai Ma played hide and seek. like two children. They were playing hide and seek in Mama's garden.
Welcome to Healing at the Edge, a podcast featuring interviews, archive talks, and teachings on conscious living, conscious dying with Ramdev Dale Borglum, brought to you by the Be Here Now Network. Dale has been a meditation teacher for nearly 50 years and has been at the bedside of the dying and their loved ones for over 40 years. He was the director of the Hanuman Foundation and founded the first Center for Conscious Dying in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's taught with Stephen Levine, Ram Dass, and countless others on the spiritual path. Dale is still working with the dying today. For more information, please visit livingdying.org.
Hello, this is Ramdev on the Healing at the Edge channel of the Be Here Now Network. I'm the director of the Living Dying Project, and we're in the process of adding some people to our board of directors. And among them, I'm so happy to report that I have asked Mukti Ma Hapsburg to be on our board of directors. She agreed. And last night, she and I were having a business meeting about the Living Dying Project and started talking about Maharaji stories in the good old days. And she had such wonderful stories that I felt would be a total shame if they were not recorded in some way so people could hear them in the future, that I invited her to do this podcast today. So here I am in California, and here is my dear friend Mukti Ma in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Welcome. So good to see you this morning.
Oh, so good to see you. Ram Ram.
Ram Ram. So Mukti Ma is a spiritual teacher in her own right, and she used to lead enlightenment intensives. She was good friends with Ram Dass, but primarily she went to India, spent time with Neem Karoli Baba and with Ananda Mai, both of whom I spent time with. Our paths did not meet in India. Ram Dass and I and a bunch of people got kicked out of India because we'd overstayed our visas before Mukti got there. But after we came back to America, we've crossed paths in so many wonderful ways. Maybe you could tell us how you got to India in the first place. You told me that story last night, and it was so delightful.
So I had been listening to Ram Dass talk about his guru. I was living in Miami before two, 3 years before, and I would go on this boat, Ken Kaiser's boat, and I would hear Maharaji, Ram Dass talking about Maharaji. And when I moved to Los Angeles and I was doing the enlightenment intensives with Charles Berner, who was my husband at the time, and I was working with people in different ways, I heard that Ram Dass was doing a benefit at the Embassy Auditorium in Los Angeles to raise money to get Tim Leary out of the St. Louis Obispo jail. So I decided to go, and Ram Dass knew me and knew Charles. And so he asked me to come on stage, and Krishna Das was there. Amazing Grace was there. I think Allen Ginsberg was there. A group of us were there, and we were chanting Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And I looked at Maharaji's picture. It was a big picture of Maharaji's face on stage. And I heard, "You come to me now." And I thought to myself, "Who's talking to me? I didn't drink anything. I didn't smoke anything. I'm not hallucinating. So I kept chanting Sri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram. And in the course of the evening, I heard this three times. You come to me now. It was a command, and it was just thrown at me like that. You come to me now. So I went home, and the next morning, I used to do laps, swim in the swimming pool every morning. And after I did my laps, I said to my husband, Charles, I said, Charles, I have to go to India. And he said, are you mad? Have you lost your mind? Because of you, we have scheduled a 5-day enlightenment intensive, a 14-day enlightenment intensive, and a 21-day enlightenment intensive. You can't leave. It's because of you. You didn't think 3 days was enough. And so I looked at him and I said, I have to go to India. You have all the staff you need. You have all the help you need, but I have to go. So he said, okay, you can go. I can only give you $200. Because Charles had an ex-wife and 7 children, and all the money that we made basically went to the support of his children. So I thought, okay, I have to go to India. What shall I do? And so a man that I had been giving therapy to came to me and said, I hear from the school, because we had a school and we had people we were working with. I heard that you want to go to India. I will give you a ticket and $200. So here I was with $400 and a round trip ticket to India. I arrive in Nainital, and I asked where Baba is. And they told me that Baba went to the mountains. He's not here. So I went to a chai shop, a tea shop. I sat down and I closed my eyes and I said, Baba, if you have really called me, and you please direct me to you, to where you are. Please bring me to you. And no sooner had I said that and opened my eyes, there was a sadhu, a renunciate monk, I guess, chimtas. Are they called chimtas? What are they called?
Chimtas are the long iron fire tongs where a sadhu carries. Sometimes all they own is a set of chimtas and a water bowl, a lota.
Right.
And so when they're seated around the fire at night, they can tend the fire with the chimtas.
Right. Okay. So he came, dung, dung, with a sound, you know, and he said, you want to see Nim Karoli Baba? Nim Karoli Baba, I take you. So we got into a taxi and we went to Kenchi. And as I went into the temple, when I got to the Durga, there's a relief of Durga's feet right before where Maharaji was sitting on the tucket. And I got to that place and I heard him say, my Mukti Ma has come. Her name is Mukti Ma. She gives, by this time I'm closer to him, she gives liberation to people. Ha ha ha. He started to laugh and laugh and laugh. And so.
And of course, could I interrupt? Mukti does mean liberation, the name itself.
Right. Yeah. It's the same as moksha. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So my Mukti Ma is on. And she gives liberation to people. And he looked at me very sternly then. And he said, Ma, sing me a song of liberation. And I was so surprised and stunned by the fact that here I'm going to see a being, a liberated being, and he's telling me that I, you know, that I'm the mother of liberation. And so I was tongue-tied and I couldn't do anything. I was just looking at him, just taking it all in. And he gave me sweets and he gave me fruit and the whole thing, as he did to everybody. Every morning when he came out of his room where he slept, he would call out Mukti Dena Wala Ma, which means the pusher of liberation, or the
salesperson.
The Wala, the person that goes around pushing liberation, selling liberation. You can't sell liberation, but anyway. And so So, and then he would wait for me to come and he would put his arm out. I would put my arm out and he would put his hand on my arm and I would walk him to his office where he saw all these people. Now, the funny thing, the curious thing is that 3 months later, he left his body. And 3 months later, Charles Berner, my husband, came to India on the day of the Bhandara, okay, of Maharaji's Bhandara. And he came with 15 of our students. They had all done the 21 days enlightenment intensive. And he came and he lay down on the ground sobbing because he never got to see Maharaji. So if I had allowed my rational mind to say, well, I have this to do and that to do, and I can't go now, Maharaji, you just have to wait, I would have never seen him.
Yeah.
I just listened. I'm a very good student. I really am. I've been like that all my life. And I listened. And so when I heard that 3 times, it was just undeniable that I had to go. He was calling.
Maybe I could tell my story about meeting Maharaji. So I had met Ram Dass when I was a graduate student at Stanford. He and I became drinking buddies. And whenever he'd come to Northern California, he'd stay at Joel's house with my buddy who lived right across the street. Joel had been at Millbrook after Ram Dass and Leary got kicked out of Harvard. And I remember actually being in the back of Joel's convertible with Ram Dass and Joel in the front, and we were eating opium and driving down the hills and outside of Palo Alto. And I thought, I'm the luckiest yogi in the world. So anyway, Muktananda came, and there's a whole Muktananda chapter, but Ram Dass said, I'm inviting you and some other very pure young men to go and be with my yoga teacher, Haridas Baba. So he invited me and Dwarka and Danny Goleman and who's now Jagannath, of course, and Krishnadas and Rameshwaradas and Raghu to go and study with Haridas. And in those days, I had no way of determining what a guru was. And I had a puja table with 4 pictures of exactly the same size. There was Maharaji, there was Hanuman, there was Haridas Baba, there was Muktananda, and there was Ram Dass, and they were all the same size. And I had no way of saying Maharaji was more of a guru than Ram Dass was or something. Ram Dass was only one of them I'd met, and then I met Muktananda. So I'm about to go off to India to study with Haridas, and he sends me a telegram saying, hey, I'm coming to Davis, California. If you want to study with me, don't come to India, stay there. And here is the guy that Ram Dass said, he's your connection. He's the guy you should study with. And I got as quiet as I could, and I just asked God, should I go to India not knowing anybody, or should I stay and study with Haridas, the guy that Ram Dass set me up with? And I got the message, go to India. And I went there. I spent 6 months with Muktananda. It was incredibly difficult. His ashram to me was a combination of an ashram, an insane asylum, and a prison. I mean, it was so intense. And finally, I escaped and made my way to Kenchi. First person I met was Danny Goleman out on the veranda of the Evelyn Hotel with his lungi pulled up, getting a suntan, eating white bread toast and reading a novel. And I just almost killed myself trying to get enlightened with Muktananda. And here's this guy, she's like, he's on vacation. I thought, what are these people doing even? So anyway, I went up to Kosani, where the more committed meditators supposedly were, up to the Gandhi ashram there, higher up in the mountains. We were there for a week or two, and a telegram came saying, Maharaji has returned, come immediately. And this was the first time then that Maharaji really settled down and allowed Westerners to gather around him. So we all got on this bus to go from Kosani to Kenchi. They're only about 20 miles apart, but there's a mountain in the middle. So you have to go down one valley and up the other valley. It takes, you know, many hours. We mm-hmm. stopped on the way. We got some apples, other prasad. And we get to the temple. As we're approaching, everybody's getting so excited because they're going to be with Maharaji. Ram Dass had been saying, Muktananda was the same being as Maharaji. I had just been with Muktananda for 6 months. I was not that impressed with Muktananda. I felt it was partly my fault that I couldn't surrender. Later on, finding out it was just I didn't have that connection with him. But so so everybody's all excited. I'm feeling kind of cynical. But I was the first person off the bus. I go running in there. I didn't stop to wash my feet. I didn't pranam at the different temples. I just went running around all the right corners. And there was Maharaji on the other side of the courtyard in the back of the ashram. And he saw me and he looked happy to see me. It was like the feeling I got was we were 2 5-year-olds who were best friends. And I'd been off at summer camp. And he was so glad to see me again. And I came running over to him. And I had this prasad and I just like dropped it at his feet. And he started hitting me on the head, saying, Brahmananda Yogi, Brahmananda Yogi, Brahmananda Yogi. Said that 3 times. But the main thing was I felt for the first time in my life that I was home, that I had been so unhappy doing what I was doing. I was like I'd just gotten all this education and mathematics at Berkeley and Stanford. I didn't want to be a scientist. I wanted God. And here I was in this, like, finally, it all made sense. It was certainly beyond sense. There was just something so deep in my heart that just broke open. And it all happened in that one moment. Certainly since then, there's been a lot of work to do. There's been a lot of confusion and this and that. But the bottom line is that there's that solid place of I'm with Maharaji. I know why I'm on this planet. I know what my work is. But then the other thing was when I was with Maharaji, at one point we were in Vrindavan and Anandamayi was there at the same time. So in the morning we'd go be with Anandamayi, in the afternoon we'd go be with Maharaji, then in the late afternoon, early evening, we'd go be with Anandamayi, and then we'd go back to the guest house and Ram Dass and all of us would sit down and talk about what had happened during the day. Maybe you could say a little bit about your experience with Anandamayi.
Oh my goodness, yes. Yes, that must have been a real, that was a blessing to be able to have Maharaji and Ma, on the same day having darshan. After Maharaji left his body, I went to Delhi. And I was at the Evelyn Hotel, at the, what's the hotel in Delhi that we all stayed? It was a...
I don't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
Palace Heights,
correct, in Connaught Place. And I was there and somebody said to me, Anandamayi is here in Delhi. And they gave me an address, you want to go? Do you want to go? So I said, yes, of course. And I walked into this hall where Ma was sitting and my knees buckled. I couldn't stand up anymore. My body just went on my knee, on the knees, just spontaneously. And then after they stopped the kirtan and Ma left, and then she came back, and while she was gone, I went really close to her. I went by her seat, and when she came back, she one look into my eyes, and that was it. I just followed her around like a puppy dog. I stayed for, I guess, 9.5 years until she left her body. I would follow her around wherever she went. She gave me diksha, initiation. One time I was so upset about the ashram because they were Bengali Brahmins. Ma was a Bengali Brahmin. And when she was very young, she asked the people around her, how shall this body act? How do you want this body to act? Do you want this body to mingle freely with all, or do you want this body to adhere to Brahmanic Brahmanic rules? And they said, oh, Ma, you stick to Brahmanic rules. So she said, so be it. And so the ashram was a terrible place for Westerners. They would feed the invited guests. They would feed They would feed the swamis, they would feed the invited guests, they would feed the beggars, and then only they would feed the Westerners outside the ashram wall. This is how bad it was.
Yeah.
You know,
because we were not part of the caste system.
Right. And we've eaten cow meat once in our lifetime. That was like juta. We were unclean. So it was very, very difficult to be near Ma. However, when she saw injustices, like when I was in Jagannath Puri and they wouldn't feed me and I was the only Westerner there, and I would go outside, you know, I would go outside her house and I would just watch her for hours and hours and hours through a window. And she would go, "Did you eat?" And I would just pranam to her. And then somebody would run down and bring me food, you know, to eat. So, but one time I went to her and I said, "Ma," I said, first of all, they wouldn't let me close to her. So finally I said, "Ma, Ma." And when I said that, she said, "Bolo." And when she said "Bolo," which means speak, everybody had to part so I could go near her, you know? And, I said, "Ma, why do you have rakshasas around you, you know, demons around you?" And she started to laugh. She said, "The sick ones go to the doctor. The well ones stay at home." That told me. The sick ones go to the doctor. Not the ones that are well stay home.
So when we were on Maharaji, he began to let the Westerners do some of the cooking in the kitchen at the... particularly
this
up the Kenchi.
This would never happen with Ma.
And of course, the Indians were scandalized because they were being asked to eat food that were not being cooked by Brahmins. So these Brahmins are supposed to eat only certain kinds of foods. And like Dwarka was in the kitchen cooking.
I know.
And Maharaji just kept beating down everybody's concepts of what's pure and what's right. And really the only important thing is love.
Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely, yes. Yes. And one time I ran to her, I was so frustrated. I said, "Ma, I want liberation now. I want moksha now." And she started to laugh and laugh. She said, "In order to have a meal, you have to go to the bazaar. You have to get the vegetables. You have to bring them home. You have to wash them. You have to cut them up. You have to put them in the pot. You have to cook them. Then only can you eat."
Yeah, I guess we know what the metaphor is there.
Yes, definitely. You've got to do your work.
So do you have any wonderful stories about Maharaji or Anandamayi, miracle stories or stories where you felt such deep love or anything that might inspire people?
Well, Maharaji blasted my heart. You know, he called me in a room. He threw everybody out and he called me in his office, I guess. No, it was a different room. It was not his office. It was another room. And he made me bar the door and he motioned for me to sit on the tucket with him. So I went and I sat on the tucket and then he grabbed me and rocked me in his arms like a little child. And I cried and cried. Just everything that I was holding in my heart just came out. And I cried and cried and cried. And he let me cry and he rocked me and he rocked me. And then finally, he pushed me away and he took his three fingers and put them in my mouth three times like that. And then he took his hand and he pushed on my heart and he said, "Heart," three times on my heart. And when he did that, it was like my heart chakra just shattered. I mean, it just blasted open. And then he took his hand and put it three times on my head. And then he told me to leave. And that whole transaction with him, that whole interchange. And then he closed his eyes. Before he told me to leave, he closed his eyes. And I felt like he was seeing all my births and everything. That he could see everything, the future, the past, everything. And then I went out. And from that moment on, I could not close my heart again. Even though there were very painful things that, you know, that you would want to close your heart to, you know, that would be your first impulse would be, oh, well, I couldn't close my heart anymore. It was just wide open, and it was going to remain like that. That was a miracle for me.
What a wonderful story.
You know, I went outside this room and I sat down, and I don't remember. I think 2 days passed. Dorca said that I was nobody could talk to me. I was gone. I was not there. Something, he rewired me. He did something to me for sure. But you know, the only thing that I've ever wanted from the time I was a little girl was to know God. And I've lived my life to the exclusion of anything else. I've only wanted to know God and to love God. And I remember I was in New Jersey, and my aunt came to New Jersey, and she came to me and she said, "Honey, do you remember when you were 17 years old and you were sitting on the sofa and you were sobbing and just sobbing?" And I said to you, "Honey, what's wrong?" And you said, "Aunt Stella, I want to know God more than I want anything." And I didn't remember that specific time, Ram Dave, but I remember all the times I cried for God, to know right. God. Huh. So Maharaji saw that, obviously, and he rewired me.
Yeah, I had a very different, I never got the I guess when I was 17 years old, I was still interested in going to college and girls and different things like that. Maybe a tougher case or something.
No, I don't think so. The thing is that when I was 5 years old, I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought, and this was very, very unacceptable for a five-year-old. I thought, what happens to me after I die? Is there no more me? And that was unacceptable. At 5 years old, you're so full of yourself, you can't imagine not existing, you know? And so my nanny came in because I was crying, and I said, no, this is too important. I want my mother. So my mother came in and I said, "Mama, what happens to me after I die? Is there no more me?" And my mother put her hands on my head and said, there, baby, you're too young to think of things like this." And when my mother, who was everything to me at that time, she was God to me, you know, and when my mother didn't know, then I had to know. So that propelled me I didn't want to study. I didn't want to do anything. I wanted to know what happens to me after I die, if there's no more me. And that intention of finding out what happens to me after I die got me to, who am I? What am I? What is life? What are we doing here together? What is death? What is life? What is death? And I only went for that, to the exclusion of almost everything.
What has your experience been of Maharaji since he's left his body?
He's constantly with me. You know, I went to, somebody said, "Go to this psychic," you know, and I said, "I don't need a psychic." They said, "He's really good, you know, go." So I walked in and he said, "Who is that man that is sitting on your right shoulder with a blanket, this fat old man?" I said, "Oh," and he said, "And who is that woman in white sitting on your left shoulder?" So yes, they're with me all the time. They're with me all the time. I talk to Maharaji. The first thing I see when I open my eyes in the morning, you know, is this picture by my bed. Sometimes I see him dancing in my garden.
No wonder you're so happy all the time.
It's true.
One time Balaram was with Maharaji with some Indian people, and Maharaji turned to the Indian people and pointed at Balaram and said, "He has been my disciple for countless lifetimes." Maybe said devotee. I can't remember. It's devotee or disciple. "But he has been with me for countless lifetimes."
I love it.
And I mean, it's a really tricky thing. I teach these groups And the last group, we were talking about meditation and about mantra. And so many people have the question, you're lucky you got a mantra from Maharaji. Now Maharaji's not in his body. And I read a book and I like this mantra, but it's not like I got it from Maharaji. And how do I know if it's the right mantra? How do I know? And just to explain to people that the person who says the mantra, the essence of the mantra, the sound of the mantra, they're all exactly the same thing, that the God, Guru, and Self are the same, and that you can use the mantra as a vehicle to get somewhere, that I feel separated from Maharaji, so if I say a mantra, maybe I'll get closer. But there's another way of being with a mantra, that each sound is Maharaji, is Ram, is Hanuman, whoever is the mother, that each sound is worship. Each sound is total connection, a total union. And but one has to be ripe to have that experience.
Yes. Yes. And I've given people mantras. They've asked me for mantras, and I haven't done it. I haven't given the mantra. I will sit and I will ask Maharaji or Ma, depending. And then I get a mantra, and it's not me giving that mantra. And of course, I feel that it comes from Maharaji, you know? And I can't give a mantra. I don't know what I'm doing. I really don't. I'm an automatic pilot. I've given myself to God completely. Well, as completely as I can, you know, having a form. But it's up to the person. You know, the story about the guy that there was a great devotee of this guru, very prominent guru, and he kept repeating his guru's name continuously, day and night, day and night, day and night. And absent-mindedly, he went to the riverbanks and then he walked on water. So the people of the village saw this and they ran to the guru and they said, "Oh, great Maharaj, great saint, great guru, you're so great that your devotee walked on water." And so when they left, the guru thought, "Haha, I am so great. I am so powerful. I'm going to go walk on water." So he went to the river and he drowned. So the moral of the story is the purity of your seeking gets you there. It's not how pure the guru is really, although I could not be taught by anything but purity. You know, I had to go for the, you know, for the purest of the pure, I guess. But it's what you do with it. You know, what you have is a gift from them. And what you do with what you have is your gift back to them. Right?
Yeah, they say in India that the work of the guru takes place in 1 second, and then you have to, the guru shows you, and then you have to bring it into manifestation.
Correct.
But I mean, it's such a conundrum. It's so confusing that Maharaji says, "I'm not this body." They don't understand who I am. And yet he called you into his room and held you when you cried and patted you on the head and the heart and put his fingers in your mouth. And so his body was doing that. And on one hand, when I was in India, I was not as attached to Maharaji's body as a lot of people. For me, it was more an inner thing. When mm-hmm. Maharaji died, it was very sad, but it didn't bother me as much as it bothered, like, Krishnadas, for instance, who I knew really well at that time. I mean, he was just completely devastated. And for me, it was, well, I don't have to fly back to India anymore now. I don't have to say I'm missing out because I'm here and he's there. It's like he's everywhere. I knew that all the time, but now I really know it. And I've always been a little jealous of people who have this very physical relationship with the guru that has to do with the stories and touching and, you know, like these immediate kind of outer blessings, it seems. And on the other hand, it feels like there's something very, very pure and impersonal as well. There's another kind of love too. And after I was with Maharaji, I felt him. I don't know if he was on my shoulder, but I felt his presence all the time. He was talking to me. I was talking to him. And then at one point, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago or something, he died 50 years ago next year. Last year was the 50th anniversary of me being with him. So I don't know, like 25 years ago or something, all of a sudden, I couldn't feel him anymore. I couldn't hear him. And I felt, I guess I'm a bad devotee. He's abandoned me because I haven't been meditating enough or something. I mean, I know he would never abandon me, but that's what my mind was saying. And I felt this way for months. And then finally, I got this message. And he said, it's time for you to fly with your own wings. I've given you what you need. It's time for you to be yourself and not just a devotee, but to be who you are. And we're all devotees. It's not like I'm abandoning you, but I want you to, you know, your wings are strong enough to get out of the nest and fly around the world and do the things that an adult bird would be doing, so to speak.
How beautiful.
Yeah.
When he did this with me in the room where he held me and he rocked me and he did all these things, putting his hands in my mouth and my head and my heart. After that, there was really no attachment to his form.
Right.
You know, I don't know. As I said, he did something because I wasn't attached to his form. He was here all the time. He was in my heart. Mm. So, and there is a story. I was this body was adopted by a royal family in India, and they adopted me, legally adopted me, so I could stay in India as long as I want, and I had a family in India. It was wonderful, and the Rajmata had a house in Nainital, and Ananda Mayama would go there to visit because she was that family was a great devotee family of Ananda Mayama, very close to her, second generation. I mean, the Rajmata's mother-in-law was devoted to Ananda Mayama. So Maharaji one time went there. And so did Sidima. Sidima saw this because she and I discussed this, you know, when I was with her. And Maharaji and Ananda Mayama played hide and seek, like two children. They were playing hide and seek in Mama's garden.
Well, when we were there, one day we were with Maharaji and he said, let's go over to Ma's place in Vrindavan. And we all traipsed over with him. And or, I don't know, maybe that's not true. Maybe we were there and he came unexpectedly. But anyway, we were there with Maharaji and Anandamai in the same room. And he came and sat by her and she started feeding him.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, Ma can do this. Only Ma can feed me. And he was like just a little child around her in a certain very pure way.
Yeah. Yes, it was wonderful. Yeah.
So any final comments before we part and offer this podcast to the universe?
Open your heart. Open your heart to love. Open your heart to God. Open your heart to yourself.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for agreeing to support the work of the Living Dying Project.
I'm excited. I'm honored and excited to do this.
And I look so much forward to being able to do this together and to deepen our friendship. So touching your feet, and we will talk soon.
I touch your feet, Baba.
Ram Ram.
Ram Ram.